I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for episode 17, A Call for Justice. Tonight, we're on the case in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The well-known spring break destination became the backdrop for an unimaginable double homicide when a single mother and her young daughter were found murdered inside their home. Susan and Shane Hamway's death outraged the community and mobilized a call for justice heard across the entire state of Florida. It was close to 5 p.m. on November 8, 1983, when Officer Ted Shendell and his partner were dispatched to look into a disturbance on a quiet residential street just about a mile from the beach.
Your basic middle-class neighborhood, not much criminal activity at all. So as I was responding to the call, it was just another routine suspicious incident. I really didn't have that many concerns.
But that changed when he saw Susan Hamway's frightened friends waiting for them in the driveway.
I could see that they were nervous. They had found some things that concerned them.
No one had heard from Susan and her young daughter Shane in nearly a week.
They hadn't seen her. She hadn't shown up for work. They kept trying to contact her over the weekend. No answer. So they went to the house to see if everything was okay.
They feared that something awful had happened to them.
They said they checked the front door, and when they realized that it was open, they called the police.
One of her friends had already walked around the side of the house and had looked into the window.
She could see directly into the master bedroom. She saw an overturned jewelry box, and the whole bedroom was ransacked.
After hearing their story, Shendell and his partner entered the house with their guns drawn and quickly realized that Susan's friends had been right.
Upon entering the residence, we were hit with a horrific stench. We knew what we were about to find. It was the smell of death.
The two policemen searched the home.
We had our weapons drawn. We didn't know what to expect.
It was Officer Shendell who made the first tragic discovery in the kitchen.
When I turned the corner of the refrigerator, that's when I saw Susan.
The single mother's lifeless body was sprawled out on the floor, surrounded by puddles of dry blood.
It was apparent that she had been deceased for quite some time.
She appeared to have been sexually assaulted during the attack.
She was naked from the waist down.
The rookie police officer was stunned by the amount of overkill that had gone into the vicious murder.
The telephone cord had been wrapped around her neck. In her chest was a knife. Whoever had stabbed her with that knife stabbed her with such force that the wooden handle of the knife had broken off.
While Officer Shendell was attempting to process the crime scene in the kitchen, his partner made a heartbreaking discovery in the nursery down the hall.
My partner screen. He had found a small child in a crib, deceased.
Lying on her back, next to two empty baby bottles, was Susan's 18-month-old daughter, Shane. She had died from dehydration.
A small child left to die. It's unimaginable. I remember that like it was yesterday, and I'll probably take it to my grave.
Shaken by the gruesome discovery, the young officers had to refocus.
When you get to a certain point as a police officer, you just resort back to all your training, and you start making sure that, you know, evidence is secured or not compromised.
Confident the scene was secure, they called headquarters.
That's when we got on the radio, contacted our supervisors that we had a double homicide. We waited for homicide detectives and crime scene technicians to arrive at the scene.
When detectives searched the house for clues, it was clear that it was ransacked, but it didn't look like a typical home invasion. Detective Gary Ciani.
We couldn't find anything missing.
Police also didn't find any signs that the home had been broken into. Sergeant Tim Bronson.
No forced entry at all.
Detectives believed that the evidence suggested that the killer was someone Susan had allowed into her home. Officer Ted Schendel.
We went around the perimeter of the house looking for a point of entry. We didn't find a point of entry.
Detectives began to piece together a frightening scenario.
She was away from the baby, and usually a mother's instinct, if something happens, they go right to their child. So you begin to wonder, is this somebody that she had known or knew?
Investigators turn to the community for help.
You start interviewing neighbors, you start interviewing her friends. We had a roadblock set up that we interviewed every car that came by.
Detectives questioned Susan Oakes, a close friend and neighbor, who said she had last spoken with Susan a week before. They had been talking on the phone when their call was cut short by the doorbell ringing. Susan's friend, Susan Oakes.
I was on the phone with her, and she had to get off the phone. Someone was at the door.
Authorities suspected that Susan had willingly opened the door for her attacker, and it appeared he had left behind a clue.
So it was a red human hair.
Detectives were hopeful that the hair would lead them to the killer.
We canvassed the neighborhood. We were knocking on every single door. Anybody that would come to the door, we'd talk to, and then we'd ask, anything out of place? Do you have any concerns in the neighborhood? They were just saying, you know, how could anything like this happen? She was such a sweet and wonderful woman. Can't imagine anything like this happening in our neighborhood.
As investigators worked to track down Susan and Shane's killer, their loved ones struggled to cope with their loss. For many of Susan's friends, it was hard to believe that anyone would have a motive to hurt the vibrant young woman who was trying so hard to forge a new life for herself and her daughter.
She was ambitious and confident. Her foremost plan was to be there for Shane and be a good mother.
Susan had moved back to Fort Lauderdale after her marriage to successful contractor Paul Hamley had ended.
Paul just didn't want any part of the marriage. He didn't seem to be committed.
In fact, Susan's marriage to Paul had been so strained in the months leading up to their divorce that friends believed that Paul was the first person police should be questioning.
He was abusing her.
She made a police report that he had assaulted her, and it became a very nasty divorce. Even Susan Hanway's divorce attorney was fearful of how bad this was.
According to the divorce agreement, Paul would be required to pay close to $180,000 in alimony and child support to Susan. Police reasoned that the hefty sum could have been a motive for murder. They decided to bring Paul in for questioning.
Paul Hanway lost this divorce settlement, and he was going to have to pay a lot of money.
But despite the tension between the couple, police discovered that Paul Hanway had an airtight alibi.
He had a broken ankle. He was in surgeries with doctors. I mean, he had an abundance of people that backed up his alibi. He couldn't have been there.
And there was another reason why detectives believe that Hanway wasn't involved. Author Dennis Bailey.
Even a father responsible for the murder of the mother, to simply leave a child lingering in the crib until she dies is almost too large a pill to swallow. It's hard to believe a father would do that to his child.
With nothing to tie him to Susan's murder, detectives decided to shift their focus to the other men in Susan's life.
We started looking at boyfriends, ex-boyfriends, dates.
And that's when information was developed that there was somebody in the neighborhood that people had a concern over.
There was at least one admirer of Susan's whose name kept coming up again and again. John Purvis. Susan's friends and neighbors were adamant that he needed to be questioned about the crime.
You want to look at a strange guy? You want to look at something in the neighborhood? Look at John Purvis.
Police asked neighbors for a description of John, and they were intrigued by what they heard.
Johnny Purvis had reddish-colored hair.
It was the same color hair detectives had found at the crime scene. Police learned that John Purvis was a diagnosed schizophrenic who lived just three houses down from Susan. In the weeks leading up to Susan's murder, neighbors believed he had been giving Susan a little too much attention. Author Dennis Bailey.
She had expressed some concern to friends and family that he obviously was attracted to her to the level that it bothered her.
Susan's friends had been alarmed by the behavior of the mentally ill man.
He would find reasons to go by the house. He would find reasons to say hello to her, to wave to her. Just a too frequent presence, an uninvited too frequent presence.
In fact, one friend told police that Susan had become uneasy with John's interest.
She said at first it was just a friendly neighbor thing. He'd come over, help her out, do things for her. He kind of stood his distance but was helpful, polite. As time went on, she noted that he became more aggressive. He would want to be closer to her, touch her, and she started to become frightened, scared, nervous.
Several neighbors witnessed this odd behavior.
The neighbors said they were starting to get concerned with John that he'd all of a sudden be there. He would pop up.
His bizarre actions had made Susan increasingly uncomfortable.
The movie The Shining was out. He would knock on the door like it was the movie. He would say, "It's Johnny."
On the Case, the podcast, will continue in a moment.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
When police looked into the background of John Purvis, they found out that Susan wasn't the only woman who had had problems with him. The 42-year-old had a history of harassing women. Detective Gary Ciani.
According to his own pharmacist, he was in the store and started to get more aggressive towards women that were shopping. Every direction you went led to John becoming more and more aggressive.
Sergeant Tim Bronson.
They had a police report where he had made a lewd comment to a female.
The day after Susan Hamway's body had been found, police interviewed John Purvis. To detectives, John seemed very nervous and defensive. And over the course of their interrogation, his behavior began to raise some serious red flags.
John, you know why we're interested in talking to you? Because you live in a neighborhood where a young lady was killed.
Yeah, I know that.
Were you over at the house?
I was down at the house, yes.
Okay.
I did not kill the girl. I did not kill the girl at all. I didn't
say that you did.
I just had a conversation with her.
What was the conversation about?
Nothing at all.
Police believe that John Purvis knew more than he was telling them. But John's mother, Emma, cut the session short.
She came in there, looked at everything, thought we were going to blame him, and he was going to get arrested.
Well, she just seemed to be, you know, very protective. In a way, it raised some red flags.
John's mother immediately hired a lawyer for her son. Investigators still had a lot of questions for John Purvis, but they would have to wait. In the meantime, detectives fanned out, looking for more evidence to connect Purvis to the murder of Susan Hamway and her baby. Meanwhile, the pressure to arrest him continued to mount.
We got nothing but bad reports about John from the neighbors.
Sergeant Tim Bronson.
They had neighbors saying he was strange. They had a police report where he had made a lewd comment to a female. A couple of Susan's friends told the detectives that Susan was kind of leery of him and she felt uncomfortable.
While the circumstantial evidence against Purvis was undeniable, it was the single red hair found in Susan's underwear that seemed to link him directly to the crime.
They had the hair that was found on Susan's body.
Author Dennis Bailey.
The police zeroed in on him because the pieces began to fit. The sexual nature of the crime, his uninvited attraction to her, his frustration level.
But that wasn't all. Investigators had also found a teenager who believed that she had heard Purvis inside Susan's house after the murder. They asked her to pick his voice out of an audio lineup.
We played an audio tape for her. She could identify John Purvis.
The case against Purvis seemed to be coming together. Detectives wanted to question him again, but a major roadblock stood in the way.
We got nothing from the family to assist us. And we were really trying to find out John's take in this.
They wanted to talk to him. And his mom said, you're done talking to my son. The mom wouldn't let him talk.
Even though Purvis was a grown man, police learned that he was completely dependent on his mother. He lived in her home just down the street from Susan. Detectives knew if there was any chance of getting more information out of John, they would have to approach him while he was alone.
We checked with his pharmacist that was giving him his medication. From talking to the druggers, we knew basically when he was in and out of there.
It was one of the few times the 42-year-old was away from his mother's watchful eye. Detectives staked out the pharmacy and waited for Purvis.
We went to the drugstore, we picked John up and brought him in for questioning. He came along freely and he never resisted.
In light of Purvis's mental condition, investigators decided to have him evaluated by a psychiatrist before any formal questioning.
We needed a professional to carry on the questioning. We weren't really qualified to deal with his type of illness. We contacted our expert, Dr. Klass. He was well known in the criminal field of psychology.
Dr. Klass had just begun his exam when out of nowhere, Purvis suddenly confessed to the murder of Susan Hamway.
Dr. Klass said Johnny blurted out he'd killed her. He jumped up and blurted out, "I stabbed her."
While the doctor was stunned, he seemed certain that Purvis was telling him the truth.
The doctor came out and told us there's no doubt he did it.
After his interview with Dr. Klass, detectives asked Purvis to give them a more detailed statement. Purvis told police that he killed Susan after she had repeatedly rebuffed his romantic advances.
John went over there, uninvited as usual, got in the house, started getting a little aggressive, probably started touching her. She was probably pushing him off, and then he just snapped.
But investigators wanted to make sure they were getting the full story. They pressed Purvis for more answers.
I don't think he completely understood what he did or why he did it. He said he loved her and wanted to have sex with her. He didn't want to hurt her. He was sexually aroused, and it finally came to its boiling point.
Then, Purvis gave the detectives details they believed only the killer could have known.
John described her underwear, and you had to be in there to be able to do that. There's nothing in the paper, nothing on the radio, nothing in any news reports that described that, and John did.
After taking down his statement, police arrested John Purvis for the murders of Susan and Shane Hamway. John Purvis's sister, Joanne Long.
My mother called me to tell me it was just 110% pure shock. Get the phone call that he's been arrested for a double homicide. There's just really no words to describe how it was other than horrible.
John's family believed that it was inconceivable that he had committed such a vicious crime. They claimed he was a 42-year-old man with the mentality of a young child.
John would have told them anything they wanted him to say. He would tell you anything to make you happy.
Then the case against John Purvis suffered two major setbacks. Testing revealed that the red hair found at the crime scene did not belong to him. And when the trial began, the judge ruled that the tape-recorded confession he had given to police was inadmissible. Sergeant Tim Bronson.
The confession was never played for the jury. It was suppressed.
Suddenly, the prosecution's case against John Purvis was in jeopardy.
The case against him was extremely weak. The only evidence really was his confession. And the fact that he had been seen on Susan's front lawn on previous occasions.
But the judge did allow Dr. Joel Klass to testify about his examination of Purvis.
He was a professional. He had great credentials.
Dr. Klass testified that John Purvis admitted to him that he had murdered Susan Hamley.
Dr. Klass's testimony was, we had a little conversation, and then he started making the stabbing motions and admitting that he had killed her.
The prosecution hoped Dr. Klass's testimony would be enough to persuade the jury.
It was just an oral confession to Dr. Klass. There was no DNA, there were no fingerprints, there's no blood, there are no hair samples, nothing. And his testimony was the critical evidence against John. Without that, there is nothing.
John Purvis took the stand and recanted that statement. He said that he had not killed Susan nor Shane. But his odd body language and his tendency to smile at inappropriate moments made a bad impression on jurors. After closing arguments, it was impossible to predict which way the verdict would go.
You had a very circumstantial case. You had no physical evidence. You had his confession, and you had a psychiatrist say that John did it.
Jurors deliberated for 8 hours, and when the verdict was delivered, they had found John Purvis guilty of Susan Hamway's murder. He was sentenced to life in prison.
He received an additional 20 years for the murder of Susan's baby, Shane.
John Purvis's sister, Joanne Long.
It was like the doors of hell were opened up. We weren't concerned about us. It was for Johnny.
Purvis's family feared for their loved one's safety.
The stories you hear about what takes place in prison, and even people who can defend themselves, horrible things happen to them, and Johnny wasn't able to defend himself.
Observers believed it was the testimony of Dr. Klass that sealed the case against Purvis.
The jury believed the confession rather than his denial in court.
The confession caused the jurors to make their decision by, you know, tying his confession together with the other testimony.
With John Purvis behind bars, there was a sense of relief throughout Fort Lauderdale. Most believed that the tragic murder of a young mother and her baby had finally been solved. But John Purvis's family was convinced that an innocent man was in prison. John Purvis's brother, Michael Bartlett.
I was devastated because I knew he didn't do it. And how are you going to get him out of there? I thought he would actually get killed in prison.
After Purvis's conviction, his mother immediately went to work trying to free her son. She believed his mental illness had caused him to confess to a crime he hadn't committed.
John Purvis's sister, Joanne Long.
My mother never gave up hope that he was coming home. She knew him better than anyone.
Purvis had already lost several appeals when his mother, Emma, spent what was left of her funds to hire a new attorney.
John Purvis's appellate attorney, Stephen Wozotsky.
I'll never forget what Emma Jo said. Before I die, I want to see my Johnny come home.
Attorney Steve Wozotsky was determined to do everything in his power to help get Emma's son out of prison.
There's no physical evidence, no circumstantial evidence. The only evidence really was his confession.
It was Purvis's own words that got him convicted.
Justice Byron White once said, in an opinion, a confession is evidence like no other, because no normal, rational person would admit to something that he or she did not do. So for Johnny to have said, I did it, I killed her and everything, was powerful evidence against him.
Was Purvis's confession true, or was it something that the mentally challenged man made up to appease his interrogators?
Most stunning of all, I think, was the fact that he confessed to killing the baby by smothering it when the baby had been left to die in the crib of dehydration and malnutrition. So, you know, John was a confessing machine.
Many were convinced that Purvis didn't understand the consequences of his confession.
He confessed to the homicide, and then he was quoted by more than one person as saying, "Now can I go home, now that I've told you what you wanted to hear?" He was very disconnected from reality.
I've handled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of first-degree murder cases. I've yet to have anybody else ever say, "Can I go home now after I've confessed?"
Almost 7 years after John Purvis was found guilty of murder, his new attorney, Stephen Wysocki, filed a formal request to examine the case file. Detective Tim Bronson of the Fort Lauderdale Police Department was asked to go through the material before it was released.
They asked me to just take John Purvis's case file and review the file.
Although he wasn't a part of the original investigation, Detective Bronson was familiar with the case. When he first began to look at the evidence, he had no reason to doubt that his colleagues had put the right man behind bars. As he studied the reports, he found obvious inconsistencies. The statements John Purvis made in his confession to police didn't match the evidence found at the crime scene.
I'm looking at John Purvis's confession. Nothing fits. Nothing fits the crime scene. He says that he strangled her with a cord that he got from his mother's house. She was strangled with a phone cord from her house. He said she had on a pink shirt. She had on a brown shirt. He said she had on black or brown pants. She had on white pants. John Purvis blurted out he had stabbed her two or three times. Well, she was stabbed just once. And I'm looking at the crime scene photos, and I says, no, nothing fits.
The discrepancies were disturbing. Detective Bronson wondered how John Purvis had been convicted in the first place.
You had a very circumstantial case. You had no physical evidence.
He asked his friend, Prosecutor Tony Lowe, to read the file.
Tim and I both felt we need to look at this more closely.
As they looked through the evidence, the two men reached the same conclusion. That it was not John Purvis who had killed Susan Hamway and her baby.
I don't think he did it. We need to look elsewhere. We need to find the person that did the crime.
But if Purvis wasn't the killer, who was? More on The Case, the podcast, after this.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Many in the Fort Lauderdale Police Department were angry at the decision to reopen the high-profile murder case. Bronson and Lowe were convinced that the real killer was still a free man. They felt their department had failed. Sergeant Tim Bronson.
This is my agency. How could this have happened? How the hell did this happen?
Bronson and Lowe then went to their bosses and told them that they believed that an innocent man was in jail.
We met with the state attorney and with the chief of police and said we might have a problem here. And both of them said, do whatever you need to do to correct the problem.
But it wouldn't be an easy problem to correct. The only way to get John Purvis out of jail was to track down the real killer.
I don't remember ever working so hard on a case in my life as I did this one.
It had been 9 long years since John Purvis had been put behind bars for the murders of Susan Hamway and her baby Shane.
But had justice really been served? Veteran homicide investigator Tim Bronson says this case affected him like no other. A helpless John Purvis had been placed in the prison's general population like a lamb amongst wolves.
There was nothing else that I thought about. John Purvis was in a correctional institute in Florida, and I called them, and I found out that he had developed skin cancer because Mom didn't tell him to get out of the yard, get out of the sun. His teeth were all rotted because Mom wasn't there to tell him to brush his teeth.
Purvis was also incapable of defending himself against the other inmates.
Someone had told me that there was 30 people deep in line to use the telephone at the facility, and he'd be number 30. And when he'd get to number one, an inmate would go to the back, and he'd go and wait 30 more, and go and wait 30 more.
Prosecutor Tony Lowe was angry that an innocent man had been convicted and incarcerated. Assistant State Attorney Tony Lowe.
There are two tragedies that have occurred. There's a man that I believe to be innocent in prison, serving a life sentence. And there is a person or people responsible for two of the most horrific homicides I've ever investigated walking around.
Bronson and Lowe continued to dig deeper, intent on finding the real killer. In the files, they came across a note that raised a major red flag.
That's when we found what we refer to as the letter from Aspen.
There's a memo in this case file. It seems to indicate shortly after the conviction of John Purvis that information came to light that Purvis may not have been the person that killed Susan Hamway.
The letter contained a statement from a police informant who claimed that his own father had committed the murder.
Basically, it says that his father was involved in murder in Florida, where he was hired by someone to kill someone in Florida, somebody's wife.
The informant had told Aspen Detective Gary White that the victim's name was Susan Hamway. The details he provided police seemed to support his story. Detective Gary Ciani.
I was getting the information that nobody could have known the position of the body after the murder, certain things that they did in the house to make it look like a robbery.
The information had been passed on to Fort Lauderdale police after Purvis's conviction. Bureaucratic red tape had kept investigators from following up on the lead.
In the memos, it appears that our office made repeated overtures to try to get more information about the information that initially came to us. And our multiple attempts were unsuccessful.
For Bronson and Lowe, the letter was an invitation to reinvestigate the whole case. As they went back through all the evidence, the two men became even more certain that John Purvis had not killed Susan Hamway and her baby.
Who had a motive? Why would anybody want a 38-year-old lady dead?
Detective Bronson now believed he had found a clear suspect, someone who had a reason to want Susan Hamway dead.
Paul Hamway was the only person that had a motive to kill Susan Hamway.
But Bronson knew that Susan's ex-husband, the father of her child, had not physically committed the crime. Colorado police had passed along information that indicated that a man named Bob Beckett had executed the hit. But Bronson believed that Paul Hamway was the man behind the gruesome double homicide.
Paul Hamway was going through this divorce, and he didn't want to pay. Money was everything to him, according to the people I talked to. He initiated this whole thing. He's the mastermind.
Was it possible that Paul Hamway was responsible for his wife and child's death?
He had gotten away with it. Not only had he gotten away with it, someone else was doing time for it.
Despite all the details the informant had given to police, investigators still didn't have enough evidence to make an arrest.
We had pushed as hard as we could. We moved as fast as we could. But then we hit a wall, too, because we can't get more information.
They believe the only way they would ever bring Paul Hamway to justice and free John Purvis was to convince the hitman, Bob Beckett, to turn on the man that hired him.
We met with the prosecutors and the state attorney. Somebody's got to get a deal, or otherwise Johnny Purvis is not going to get out of jail.
The state's attorney's office agreed, and a deal was negotiated. Bob Beckett, the man they believe actually executed the double homicide, would be given total immunity in exchange for his cooperation.
If we give a murderer immunity, generally that's not a good thing at all.
But prosecutors believe that granting Beckett immunity from the homicide charge was John Purvis's only hope of becoming a free man.
The overriding concern is there an innocent man in prison doing a life sentence that shouldn't be there? And so at the end of the day, I think we all felt comfortable with what had to be done.
The first step of the arrangement called for Bob Beckett to confess to the murder.
Well, I was contacted by Hamway, and he told me that he wanted his wife killed. They had been going through a divorce. The settlement didn't go well for him.
Beckett said he used the $14,000 that Paul Hamway had paid him to hire an accomplice named Paul Cirio. He said they flew to Fort Lauderdale armed with Susan's home address. Beckett knew he wouldn't have any problem getting into the house. As a friend of Paul Hamway's, he had met Susan several times before.
I knocked on the door. She was on the phone with someone. She recognized me, and I told her that I had a couple of things that I thought might be helpful with her ongoing arguments and stuff with Paul Hamway. She let us in.
Beckett said Susan invited them in and offered them a glass of water. As Susan walked to the kitchen, Beckett attacked her.
I struck her from behind with the pistol to render her unconscious. When I did, she fell back, and I put my hands around her throat. I was trying to choke her.
Beckett grabbed a knife and plunged it into Susan's chest. Cirio helped him stage the scene to make it look like rape had been the motive. The two then rifled through Susan's bedroom and left the house. They headed to the airport and flew home. Then Beckett revealed a shocking detail. The death of baby Shane had not been part of the deal.
He had told Hamway that they couldn't kill a child. The plan was for Beckett to call Hamway, and Paul was going to call a friend of Susan's and have someone go and find the child.
Beckett claimed he had called Hamway and confirmed that Susan was dead, but Hamway never contacted anyone to save his daughter. Police believed he knew it meant certain death for Shane.
Paul Hamway never made a phone call. And I don't think he ever had any intention of making that phone call.
According to Beckett, Paul Hamway had let his own child die a slow and painful death. And there was a reason Hamway would want Shane dead.
most of the money from the settlement was going to Shane. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind that he did not want Shane to live.
Prosecutors knew they were going to need more than the confession of the killer to arrest Paul Hamway. With Beckett's help, they obtained hard evidence of how the hit unfolded.
He filled in more of the blanks, helped us to complete the puzzle about what had gone on. We immediately set about to try to corroborate that. The name that he used in order to come from L.A. to Fort Lauderdale, and he rented a car on somebody else's credit card. All of those things we were able to document.
Then they tried to use Beckett to get Paul Hamway to confess to his role in the crime during a tape-recorded phone call.
Hello.
Yeah, Paul.
Yeah.
This is Beckett.
Hi, buddy.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Right now I'm not doing very well at all.
Really?
But Paul Hamway seemed to know what was happening.
Listen, when I talked to you in your office about doing a number on Susan for you.
What are you talking
about? You talked to me about...
What are you talking about?
Listen, I'm in enough trouble right now. I need some help here financially, too.
Well, listen, I've always been able to help you. I always will help you, but I don't know what you're talking about with this Susan thing. I don't know what you're talking about.
Look, Hamway, I did this. I killed her for you. I need some help.
Wait a minute. I don't know what you're talking about.
At first, investigators were disappointed that Paul Hamway hadn't confessed. But as they listened to the conversation more carefully, they realized that he had given them a lot more than he had intended.
If Hamway is truly the heartbroken ex-husband whose wife and child were ripped from his life, why didn't he ever call the police and say, hey, Beckett confessed to me? If you weren't involved in it, you'd be screaming it from the mountaintop to make sure that justice was done.
While investigators were placing handcuffs on Paul Hamway for the murder of his ex-wife and baby daughter, Assistant State's Attorney Tony Lowe was already working on getting an innocent man released from prison.
I surreptitiously had John Purvis transported back from state prison and housed in the Broward County Jail so that we could get him out right away.
Lowe proudly recalls telling John Purvis that soon he would be a free man.
A smile slowly crept over his face, and that was really a rewarding moment.
For John's family, it was the moment they had all been waiting for. John Purvis's sister, Joanne Long.
Once the judge had made the decision that Johnny was going to be freed, he said he could go, and we actually were allowed to take him home. And then it was just the end of a happy ending to a 10-year nightmare, but really for my mother and for Johnny both. There's just really no words to describe the joy.
Almost a year later, Paul Hamway and Paul Serio were convicted of the murder of Susan Hamway. But surprisingly, the same jury ruled that her daughter Shane's death had been an accident. Both men received life in prison, the same sentence that had originally been given to John Purvis. The irony is not lost on Detective Tim Bronson.
A mistake was made, and we, the Fort Lauderdale Police and the Broward State Attorney's Office, corrected it. And that was the focus of what we had to do, is to correct it.
John Purvis has never expressed any bitterness about what he went through.
I think that's one of the reasons why I like John so much, because he's so positive. He's just a positive, positive human being.
For those that knew Susan and Shane, there's a peace of mind in knowing that the man responsible for their deaths is now in prison. But there's nothing that the justice system can do to give them back what they miss the most, watching a loving mother raise her baby girl.
Susan's friend, Susan Oakes.
She was so devoted to her daughter, and she was just, that was really heartwarming.
Shortly before their murders, Susan had written a letter to her daughter, Shane.
Dear Shane, I hope I can always do what is right for you and keep you safe, warm, happy, loved, and free. I adore you, and you mean the world to me. Life can be so hard at times, but I plan on doing the best I can for my beautiful baby girl. All my love, Mother.
In 1995, the city of Fort Lauderdale agreed to pay John Purvis $1 million to settle his wrongful imprisonment suit. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.